I feel like he kind of perpetuated that classic imagery of somebody lying on the leather couch and being like, so talk about your dreams and your subconscious, and they're like crying through this unconscious memory that they have.
Yeah, he made those up, and we use those terms all the time. Mm. We talk about it in the workplace, we put it on our dating app bios. It's like one of the questions you might ask someone on a date.
Is this like the girl with the M&Ms and her boyfriend?
Yes, and her boyfriend.
And she just gives him a little peanut M&M. You don't even realize, but these are like major psychological theories and experiments and research, and we're just putting it down to a croissant meme.
Back in the day, they would have got people lining up in front of them being like, yes sir, it was them.
Sorry?
And then they would have gone to jail.
They had Freudian freaks like you, where you're literally like, it came to me in a dream.
When you piss yourself when you see a toilet in sight. You know when you're holding on?
Oh yeah.
But you're holding on so much and you can last however long, you're like, yep. And then as soon as you know that it's in sight, it's just like Hi, I'm Dee Selman.
Hi, I'm Bib Rasmussen, and welcome to The Hookup, where we talk all things love, sex, dating, and relationships, and we research topics that you are interested in.
Yes, once a month, Pib and I get journalistic. Oh, I'm not wearing my glasses. I always like to wear them for the research.
My journalist fedora hat kind of thing.
Where we really delve deep into something. We've, you know, covered the history of marriage recently. We've looked into incels. We've looked into the birth rate dropping. It's been really, really fascinating being able to just like give a solid like 45 minutes to a topic.
Yeah.
And we asked you on our Instagram at Triple J The Hookup, what are other things that you want us to research, right?
Yeah. And something that came through that was really interesting to us was psychology and like kind of the history of it and where it's come from. And that was something that I personally had no idea about. You actually blew my mind. You were like, psychology is only about 147 years old, which I was like, oh, it's a baby science. It's like nothing.
It is. And we talk about psychology all the time.
Yeah, we have psychologists on the show all the time, like weekly.
Yeah, and we talk to you about, you know, things like boundaries, trauma, gaslighting, attachment theories, love languages, narcissists. Like there's so much like psychology that we talk about that we actually like haven't figured out where it's come from.
Yeah. So we thought in this episode, we would take a look at psychology and kind of take you through a very brief history from the very beginning, from like ancient times to then like the formal birthplace, how it's developed over the last couple of years or 100 years or so, going through that history, finding out some things that are like myths and like misconceptions and some of like the big schools of thoughts where psychology was like really wrong about.
Like, do you actually want to fuck your mom and your dad?
Yeah, like what was all that about, Freud? We're going to get that into here as well, and we're going to have a look at the DSM and where we're going potentially with psychology in the future.
All right, let's get into it. Okay, before we delve really deep into the history, let's define psychology just as a term. Psychology is the scientific study of the mind and behavior. It explores the biological, cognitive, and social processes that shape how humans and non-humans feel and act.
Non-humans like our pets?
I don't know.
I love that.
This is from Wiki, by the way.
The psychology of zoo animals. There are a bunch of core types we could go over quickly. Cognitive psychology, developmental psychology, social, biopsychology, personality psychology. And then it branches out to a bunch of different industries, which maybe you work in and you're like, oh yeah, I recognize this. Clinical psychology, counseling, industrial organizational psychology, which is like workplace psychology. Oh. Forensic, educational, health and sports psychology. There are so many.
Yeah. And like Pip was saying, like psychology didn't always look like what it looks like today. Even just 10, 20, 50 years ago, we're going to talk about the DSM later, which is the Diagnostical Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And some things have only just been added recently.
Yeah.
Like certain mental health issues. So yeah, there's a lot to unpack. But Pip, talk us through maybe like the earliest, signs of people studying psychology.
Yeah. So let's go all the way back to Greece. 400 BCE, in fact. You may know some Greek philosophers such as Plato and his student Aristotle. By the way, did not know that they were in the same timeline together. They lived together, Aristotle being his student, like Plato.
Oh.
Did not know that.
I didn't know that either. I thought they were like centuries apart.
I thought they were like well apart, but they were like literally buddies. They were pals. So they were talking and figuring out the mind and like just trying to figure out like what is the human psyche? Like where does it come from? Why do we think? Why do we feel? And that's actually where we got the word psychology from. So the Greeks were actually so influential We took their word for soul, psyche, and made it part of the word psychology. Then we fast forward to France, 17th century. A lot of good things happening in France, by the way. When we did our episode about chivalry and like romantic love.
When we unpacked the history of romantic love.
France was where it's at in like ancient times. It's crazy. But yeah, they actually developed psychology a lot as well throughout the 14th and 17th century. You might have heard of the French philosopher René Descartes. He introduced this thing called dualism. That was about like separating the mind and the body as like two different entities. And you might actually notice that I'm talking about philosophers here. We're not calling them psychologists. This is like so early that the word wasn't even like really a thing. And that's because they hadn't invented the term and they basically relied on methods such as observation and logic. And they really struggled to figure out how to like quote unquote measure immaterial things like thoughts and feelings. But if we fast forward to the real birthplace, right, where we go, okay, psychology, like where did that word really find its footing? It was actually in 1879 with a German guy called Wilhelm Wundt. And that's when he made his very first ever, the world first ever, psychology lab, which is pretty cool. So he actually had a bunch of students. He was lecturing at this university and teaching the principles of physiological psychology. So this is kind of where they like married the science and the physiology and the study of human thought and behavior. So he opened this laboratory in 1879 in Leipzig, and it was like the transition of like basically it being legitimized.
Wasn't there roughly like 17,000 students? Like it was actually huge.
Yeah, it was like the granddaddy of it. And yeah, like interestingly, a lot of Wilhelm's students actually went on to like form even bigger and more influential thoughts in terms of psychology, structuralism being one of them, and then functionalism as well. But let's talk about Freud, because like this was like the biggest moment of like psychology having a breakthrough.
Absolutely. So many of you would know of Freud. He is the most famous, most unhinged, I guess you could call him, psychologist, right? He was a physician, an Austrian physician called Sigmund Freud, and he basically changed the face of psychology in a really dramatic way. He spoke mostly about the importance of the unconscious mind, right? He spoke about our personalities being really driven about things that we wouldn't even be conscious of that dictate human behavior. And he theorized that these unconscious thoughts and forgotten memories control literally every single thing that a person does, right?
I feel like he kind of perpetuated that classic imagery of somebody lying on the leather couch and being like, so talk about your dreams and your subconscious. And they're like crying through this like unconscious memory that they have they didn't really access before. So I feel like he like started that vibe in psychology.
That is so true. And just like the tick-tocking of the clock in the room where he's just like smoking a cigar being like, tell me about your mother.
So
his major theory was he thought that the psyche was made of three parts. The ID, which is the instincts, so basically your primitive desires, your sexual and aggressive drives, and your hidden memories. The ego, which is the reality, and then the superego, which is morality. So the psyche's moral conscious. So when you think about it, it's almost like your dark, deepest desires that you're unconsciously unaware of. Then it's just like, you know, maybe your ego, what you're like aware of, but then also you've got the added layer of like society and social conditioning and like how you maybe quote unquote pretend to show up in the world just because you feel pressure to act a certain way.
Yeah. And there are obviously so many famous Freudian bits that you would know about, like the Freudian slip, which is kind of your subconscious slipping through your mind and you accidentally saying something. And then someone might remark and be like, oh, that was a bit of a Freudian slip. Like that was something deep, dark in your brain that you didn't even know you had in you. And that's what, that's kind of how that expression became a thing. Dream analysis as well. Like obviously he was like obsessed with people's dreams. He actually did a book called Interpretation of Dreams, and apparently this was quite revolutionary. Scientists actually, before this book was published, were like, dreams are meaningless, like they actually mean nothing. He was like, no, they mean a lot. And he actually said that they were disguised fulfillments of repressed infantile wishes.
Wow.
Which is kind of interesting. I'm like, sometimes people do take dreams seriously. I wouldn't normally consider myself somebody who does like lead by my dream example. But one time I did get like a warning in a dream and I like cut somebody out of my life and I've never looked back.
I love analyzing dreams.
Yeah.
And I once had a dream about something that was missing. It was like these really expensive sunglasses that I had that were like vintage. They were my dad's from when he was in the 80s. And I lost them and I had a dream. And the dream, I didn't have them for months. The dream told me exactly where they were.
That is fucking crazy.
I woke up, went straight to the bag that I used once like months ago, found them in there. The dream told me.
The dream. See, it's like somebody else will be listening to this and being like, that was just your brain like giving you a hint.
No,
like,
that is Freud.
It's Freud.
He's hinting at me. Really famously though, and this is kind of what people take the piss out of Freud nowadays, is around your Oedipus complexes. So the idea that you want to fuck your mom or your dad.
Yeah. So this is like something that has for some reason really stuck with people. For men, like, you know, Freud was kind of theorizing that boys develop like this unconscious desire to have sex with their mom and eliminate the father and like fully possess her. So that's the Oedipus complex, obviously named after a famous Greek myth. And then for women, it's not as common, but he did kind of theorize there was this other version called the Electra complex, which is kind of, it's sort of weird to say out loud, but he was saying that like females experience penis envy and the parallel reaction to the male experience of castration anxiety, which is really weird. So apparently women are jealous of their father's penis and wish to have one as well. Girls then repress this feeling and instead long for a child of their own.
That is wild to me.
This is really weird. And it's something that actually his contemporary Carl Jung coined.
Oh,
and after. This is... Yeah. So Carl was like involved in this, and Carl Jung is like somebody who I really learned a bit about through you. Like I didn't really know that much about like Jungian psychology, but you kind of introduced me to it. And I didn't know this, but Carl Jung is like, they're like pals. They're like,
oh, yeah,
collaborators with Freud.
There's
which is
a
so
whole
crazy.
Movie, if you haven't seen it, called A Dangerous Method with Keira Knightley. She basically, I think she's like the patient. And then
have
she,
you seen it?
Yeah, yeah. It's like Freud and Carl Jung together, and they basically discover psychoanalysis, and then they try and fix this patient called Sabina, and then she ends up becoming like a huge part of the psychological world as well. Like wow. She ends up becoming like, yeah. Anyway, so fascinating. Mm. But before we get on to Carl, because yes. He is a massive historical figure, basically I want to talk about the fact that Freud, because I was looking up, you know, societally at the time in the Western world, queerness and homosexuality was really frowned upon. Mm. It was considered illegal. It was like something that just like people thought was like psychologically something was wrong with you.
Yeah.
But Freud was kind of ahead of his time, because despite it being like considered this criminal, sinful thing, he actually believed that everyone was born with the potential for attraction to multiple sexes, which obviously now we would call bisexuality. But he theorized that childhood development and family dynamics influenced the eventual direction of someone's sexuality. And he thought that sexuality existed on a spectrum. And he thought queerness was actually really common. And he didn't believe in conversion therapy. So he was like, despite the time, everyone thinking it was like sinful and criminal and a sign of mental illness, he actually said, no, we're all a little bit, like there's a spectrum.
We're all a bit gay.
We're all a bit gay.
This might be the first thing that I've heard about Freud that I've enjoyed. I feel like everything else that he said, I mean, I kind of vibe with some of the dream stuff, but he was pretty kooky. And the fact that people got really into him and they were like obsessed with like his method of psychoanalysis is pretty crazy. And yeah, it's interesting because I think what we're about to find out and what I learned from researching this is that Carl Jung was like, enough of your sexual trauma undoing.
Yes.
Like he was like, I'm actually sick of your obsession with this and I'm going to move on to my own kind of type of psychology, right?
Absolutely. And he's having a massive moment on TikTok at the moment. So basically Jung, he believed that humans inherited certain psychological patterns that appear across cultures, religions, myths, and stories. And he called this the collective unconscious. So I guess in his head, he wanted to move past this idea of like Freud's strict emphasis on like sexual trauma and the unconscious and stuff. And he developed his own framework called analytical psychology. So some of his famous things that you probably know about is the archetypes. So he talks about the fact that people can be put into different archetypes. So like there's the hero, there's the wise old mentor, there's the trickster, there's the shadow.
Oh, so this is the thing that you were talking to me about, how you're like the shadow self is something that you've been noticing on TikTok a bit.
Yes.
I kind of needed to like go into this and have a look, because I was like, I don't know what the shadow self is, but do you want to explain it?
Yeah. So when you're deep, on psychology TikTok, this thing that's coming up a lot, as one is, is the shadow self. So it's this idea that like we all have this unconscious part of our personality that maybe has your repressed desires, your fears, and basically things that you hide from other people and maybe even from yourself. So it could be jealousy, anger, selfishness, your insecurities. And Jung believes that psychological growth happens when you actually recognize and interrogate your shadow rather than pretending it wasn't there.
Yeah, that sounds kind of Freudian, but then when he's saying like engage with it and realize that it's there, then it's kind of like bridging that gap of like it's unconscious, but you're like doing something about it.
It's kind of like that thought that something that triggers you in another person is actually something about yourself that triggers you.
Do you ever have those moments of like mental clarity where you're like, oh, I just realized my deep, dark insecurity about my life is X, Y, Z. And you kind of just go, whew, okay, that was a lot. That kind of feels like the shadow self being like, hi, like this is the stuff that you're kind of putting in the back of your head.
Yes.
And you're not really engaging with, but you kind of know it deep down.
Deep down it's there.
Man, I've had that so many times.
Yeah.
And I've been like, no, away with you.
We don't need to touch that.
I don't want to talk about that anymore.
He basically says like to be your best psychological self and to really grow as a person, like you need to be able to engage with those parts of yourself and almost accept them, right? He talks about the hidden potential, which is the fact that the shadow isn't inherently evil.
Yeah,
it
that's
also
nice.
Houses positive traits and talents that you suppress in childhood
because
they were discouraged by your caregivers or society. So like, you know, sometimes maybe you were like, I really love being silly or funny or whatever. And someone told you to shut up, or maybe you had someone who was like, stop being
so goofy,
you know, so goofy or you're not funny or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Then you've suppressed that.
Mm.
That's also part of like your shadow.
Yes.
So it's not necessarily these like bad things as well.
Yeah.
The thing that I was talking about before, the mechanism, people often unconsciously project their shadow onto others. For example, if you find yourself disproportionately irritated by someone else's arrogance, it might be an unacknowledged repressed desire for confidence in your own shadow. And I think we've spoken about this before with like internalized misogyny. Sometimes you might hate a girl or be like, oh, how dare she walk into the room and be so confident, or how dare she, you know, speak up and like talk. I don't know. And then sometimes when you think about it, it actually is just coming from a place of like, I wish I could do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Also, something that you taught me was that he invented the words introvert and extrovert, which is obviously one of the most enduring ways to describe somebody's energy and something that we still talk about today. So he came up with these terms in 1921. So he saw introversion and extroversion as a spectrum, not one or the other, which I think sometimes people now still get confused and they're just like, I'm an extrovert.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm like, I know I'm on a spectrum. I would be like, I'm an extrovert, but I'm like, I definitely need like time to like recharge to then be myself. Like,
but
it's crazy.
It's so fascinating because
I didn't know he made those up.
He made those up. And we use those terms all the time. We talk about it in the workplace. We put it on our dating app bios.
Yeah.
It's like one of the questions you might ask someone on a date.
Yeah.
Be like, so what are you?
Yeah, exactly.
He invented them.
Okay, so this is all happening in like the early 1900s, like 1921 is when he's like coined these things. So let's go on to the next thing. From the 1920s to the 1950s, there was this thing called behaviorism. So basically a lot of psychologists kind of got sick of this unconscious mind bullshit. They were like, stop talking about dreams and souls and start saying, where is the evidence? Like, show me the evidence. And this was kind of a rebellion against a lot of Freud stuff and a lot of repressed shit, unconscious desires, personality analysis, etc. There were a group of psychologists who were really influential here, John B. Watson and B.F. Skinner, and they were really overstudying invisible thoughts and they wanted to focus on things like, what can we actually see? And get maybe a little bit more scientific, get some method and discipline in there.
100%. They basically argued that psychology should only be studied with things that you can observe, measure, and be repeated, right? Mm. So Watson, the guy you just mentioned, is often seen as the father of behaviorism. And he claimed, give me any healthy infant and I can train them to be anything. So he basically believed, it's like the nature versus nurture. He believed that environment was far more important than your inborn personality.
So you can kind of like wire somebody to be anything if you gave them the potential.
He was like,
and the environment to
nurture
thrive.
Nurture is everything.
Okay.
So he conducted a famous experiment on a baby known as Little Albert, which would never happen today. Mm-hmm. But basically, Albert liked rats. Albert wasn't afraid of rats. and then Watson would present a white rat while simultaneously making an extremely loud, frightening noise. And then after he repeated this, Albert became terrified of the rat. And then he did this so much that Albert became scared of similar furry objects too.
Oh.
So he used this experiment to suggest that fear could be learned through conditioning.
This really reminds me of Ivan Pavlov, who actually was also very famous in the school of thought of behavioralism. And he was a Russian physiologist. And what that experiment reminded me of is Pavlov's dog, which is also another really famous psychological experiment, leading to the discovery of classical conditioning, which basically means that you can learn behaviors through conditioned associations. So what he did with this dog, or with his dogs, I think he had like a ton of them,
yeah,
is that he would like ring a bell before feeding them. So then the dogs learned that the bell sound meant food. And so they started to eventually just like start drooling and salivating with the bell alone. No food present. He would just ring the bell. And so basically what this experiment proved is physical subconscious responses can be learned and triggered by environmental cues. And this is kind of how we develop habits and phobias and cravings. So, for example, if you get that really intense urge to check your phone when you hear it vibrate or buzz, you're literally going like, oh my God, I need that hit of dopamine. And you might want to just, yeah, see what people are talking to you on your phone
or
about.
Like when you piss yourself when you see a toilet in sight. You know when you're holding on?
Oh, yeah.
When you're holding on so much and you can last however long, you're like, yep, yep, yep. And then as soon as you know that it's in sight, it's just like...
Wait. Do you have like a Pavlov's dog in your life?
I reckon I would have so many, but the one that comes to mind because I just did it last night is I have a sleep music app and to help me sleep, and you can pick, it's actually so sick. You can pick like so many different melodies. It's like you can have like thunder, you can have rain, you can have wind, you can have beach, you can have white noise, orchestra, piano, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Anyway. I reckon about like, I'm even going to say 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I chose a combo of things. Birds, rain, eternity, thunder.
Okay.
Anyway, when they all play together.
Please play it. I would love to hear this. And that just, your brain starts to go.
Instantly sleep.
Time.
Like,
time
I
to go.
I really struggle with sleep, but as soon as I play that combo. Out like a light.
If there's nothing,
it's magic.
If there's something missing, like there's
oh,
no,
if it's if some, if
no
I'm
thunder,
doing just white noise or something's missing, then
it's
like
the
it's not the same.
Interesting.
I've literally conditioned my brain that I need that exact combination of like thunderbirds,
wow,
and that melody.
Okay, does
what's
this,
yours?
Does this count as a Pavlov's dog if there are certain places that I go and I need to immediately take a shit? Is that Pavloving?
I reckon
because it's like I've somehow associated this environment and it sets like a cue up to my body to like do something.
Yeah, because you probably did it the first few times.
Yeah, I don't know. Like maybe it's really weird. This is so funny. But there's like a place at work that if I walk into a certain office, I literally am like, I have
to
go to the bathroom. I don't know what it is. And I'm like, how did it set up like that? Like, was I nervous when I first started working in this place and then suddenly I just need to go? Or like, what about the classic internet meme of like you walk into a bookshop? Like, There is thousands of people online who are like, if I go into a certain bookstore,
I need to go to the toilet.
I have to shit like immediately. Like it's like a laxative to them.
Well, this is a massive thing on TikTok at the moment where people are talking about training their like partners, and it's like,
oh my God,
it's like they'll say a certain word or they'll say a certain thing or they'll like give them a treat as a reward when they do something good.
Is this like the girl with the M&Ms and her boyfriend?
Yes, and her boyfriend,
and she just gives him a little peanut M&M when he does a good thing.
Yeah. It's so funny.
Fucking hell.
I mean, we've even spoken about it with actual sexologists and stuff because, you know, this is a bit of a side note, but they'll say like if you're having trouble with your sex life with your partner, like put on a candle and then you associate that candle every time with like getting horny.
Yeah.
So like it's really fascinating because technically like behaviorism is everywhere when you think about dating apps and social media and gambling. And one of Skinner's biggest discoveries was actually that unpredictable rewards are incredibly addictive. So basically, if you get a reward every single time, you don't know when it is coming, you're more likely to be addicted to that thing because it keeps you being like, oh, when am I going to get it?
Which is kind of why, like, yeah, as you said, gambling and notifications and addiction to phone is so intense because you never know when someone's going to message you.
Or even situationships
or
people that are addictive because – They're so hot and cold, and you don't know when they're going to text you and say you up.
Thank God for you bringing it back to psychology. I could have just talked about shitting in bookstores for half an hour. But that's, yeah, that's crazy, isn't it? So, yeah, one of the big breakthroughs in psychological history is cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, which is what psychologists still use today. Part of the whole behavioralism kind of era, and it was actually coined or invented, I guess, by a psychiatrist, Dr. Aaron T. Beck. He was globally recognized as the inventor or father of CBT, and it originally developed in the 1960s as cognitive therapy, and then it was later expanded and popularized under the broader combined term of CBT. Mm-hmm. So he basically transitioned traditional psychoanalysis after finding that his depressed patients responded much better to identifying, testing, and changing negative automatic thoughts rather than exploring their childhoods. So
yes.
Again, going away from...
So like instead of like digging deep about your unconscious mind, it's more about your thoughts shape your behavior.
Yeah.
Let's change our thoughts.
And it seems like at that point they were like, let's give people the tools to do this instead of like doing the old lie down on the black couch.
Tell me about your mum.
Tell me about your mum's shit.
Well, Pip, tell us about humanism, because this is something that we kind of reference a lot today, that famous triangle, right, about self-actualization.
Yeah, maybe you're aware of like a meme that people use, and it's like this triangle, and it's
We'll put it up on the screen here.
Yeah, we'll put it up here. It's based off this thing called the hierarchy of needs that was coined by Abraham Maslow, who is a psychologist, and he contributed to this, and he basically was like, let's look at this, and like the top one being self-actualization, and then down below, esteem needs, then belongingness and love needs, safety needs, and at the very bottom, physiological needs like food, water, and warmth. They're like the basic needs. And then the one at the top is like fulfillment, where you're just like, I'm like the greatest version of myself. So he created that, and you definitely would see it in memes where people just black out the whole triangle and just put like a croissant, and yeah. You're just like, this is all I need. But you know, this is the kind of thing with pop psych where you're just like, you don't even realize, but these are like major psychological theories and experiments and research, and we're just putting it down to a croissant meme. Like, you know what I mean?
So funny.
It's crazy how much like psychology has influenced like who we are and where we've come from. So the cognitive revolution as well is something that we should obviously talk about from the 1950s. This is something that I feel like you know a bit more about than me, but it was basically like when computers were becoming a thing.
Yeah. So I guess if we try and unpack what we've got to now, right? First, psychology was philosophy.
Yes.
Like Greece, France, blah, blah, blah. Philosophers, big thinkers. Then Freud made it about the unconscious. Then behaviorists came in and said, ignore the mind and only study behavior. And then basically cognitive revolution came after that and said, hang on, humans clearly think. Let's not just study behavior. We need to study the brain. Mm. So let's actually shift the focus back to mental processes like memory, problem solving, attention, your biases, your decision making, and language. And this is basically where psychology starts looking like the psychology we know today.
Right.
This is where we get modern mental health treatment. This is where we get evidence-based psychology. Mm. So looking at questions like, how do memories work? How do people problem solve? How do we learn language? How do we make decisions? How do we pay attention? And one of the coolest bits of context is that psychology's cognitive revolution happened at exactly the same time that computers were being invented.
Right.
Which really shaped the science of things. And this became known as the information processing model.
I could be wrong here, but it's also not only computers, but things like, I don't know, x-rays, MRIs.
100%.
Stuff like that, where they could actually, like, you know, people that we quote all the time where they're like, oh, yeah, you know, where Helen Fisher was like, oh, yeah, that part of the brain lit up when we told this person this. And it's like we started to understand things and combine science and information in such a hectic way.
Well, yeah, you realized when your computers were processing information, people started being like, okay, well, how does the brain process information?
Mm.
And one of the biggest areas of this revolution was memory. And psychologists discovered that memories are surprisingly reconstructive. So every time you remember something, your brain is partly rebuilding it, which means that memories can change. And I remember like this being like a light bulb moment like years ago when realizing, oh, this is when they figured out that in criminal cases or investigations, like eyewitnesses' testimonies aren't that like reliable.
Oh, they're terrible.
Because this was what they found out during this area of psychology. It was like, you know, no, people's memories change and people can like be biased, and that's where confirmation bias comes from.
Yeah.
So, you know, we seek information that supports what we already believe. Availability bias, we judge how common something is based on how easily examples come to mind. and the halo effect. So like one positive trait influences our overall judgment.
Yeah, I had a big light bulb moment too where I was like, human memory being faulty. And the fact that like how many times have I been in a situation where someone's recalling an event and I'm like, no.
That never happened.
That never happened. That person was on the left and they were wearing green, and also that whole thing that you said didn't happen. And then someone else is like, no. Like, how fucked are those conversations? And you literally think, if I was ever in a criminal trial, I'm like, I hope I was filming it. I hope I wrote it down straight after, because I can't remember shit.
It's like every fight you ever get in with your partner. And yes. They're like, you said this. And you're like, there is no fucking way I said that. How do you even, how are you even thinking that?
Yeah.
And then you think about the fact that like back in the day, they would have got people lining up in front of them being like, yes, sir, it was them.
Yeah.
Sorry? And then they would have gone to jail.
They had Freudian freaks like you, where you're literally like, it came to me in a dream. And it's actually your memory like poking through your unconscious and like helping you remind yourself and like all this stuff.
Isn't it wild?
Yeah. So that's really fucking fascinating. And like going back to our branches of psychology, forensic psychology. Yeah. Like obviously they did so much work to try and figure this out and understand the human mind as a brain, as a machine, as a memory vault. Mm. But something that they developed as well, which is what we talked about a little bit earlier before, the DSM. So the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. This is kind of like psychology Bible, like 101, right?
Yeah.
And they've made a couple of additions, but the very first one I think was 1952.
Yes.
So let's talk about that.
Yes. It's basically been revised repeatedly ever since. And what's fascinating about the DSM is it's every edition is kind of like a snapshot of what psychologists and psychiatrists believed about mental health in that moment in history, right?
Mm.
Which means that diagnoses have been added, removed, renamed, merged, and split over time. We're going to go through a few famous ones. The DSM-1, 1952, homosexuality was a psychiatric disorder.
Right. Okay.
Isn't that just fucked?
So it's not that long ago as well.
At the time, many psychiatrists believed, this is in the DSM, that same-sex attraction reflected psychological dysfunction.
Yeah. So mind you, this is the book that everyone would refer to be like, okay, cool, depression, anxiety, all these standard things that you would try and help diagnose a patient. In here, homosexuality, a mental disorder, which is very scary. But obviously after years of scientific debate and activism, thank God, in 1973, they actually voted to remove homosexuality as a mental disorder. And this was obviously a very huge cultural and scientific turning point.
Another thing that actually wasn't, it was renamed in 2013 in the DSM-5, gender identity disorder. So this label implied that a person's identity itself was disordered. And so this then became gender dysphoria in 2013. So just a bit of a rename.
Mm.
And the focus basically shifted away from the identity itself and towards the distress that a person may experience because of a mismatch between their gender identity and assigned sex. So
yes,
this has been huge for trans people and people who experience that dysphoria to have that completely renamed and changed. A massive one, Pip. For centuries, this is even before the DSM, women could be diagnosed with hysteria.
Right.
So this is everyday symptoms, right?
Yeah.
Anxiety, sadness, irritability, sexual desire, fainting, and emotional distress.
That's just like a normal Thursday for me.
It's a normal 2 days. It's a normal 2 days before my period.
Literally, yeah.
And the term hysteria comes from the Greek word uterus.
Mm.
But basically, we've talked about this before, I think, on The Hookup, where ancient theories literally suggested that a wandering uterus, it like moved around your body.
What?
Caused psychological symptoms. So this is how far we've come with science.
I just like hate that women bore the brunt of like so many incorrect, and still obviously to this day it's happening, but things like hysteria and like being called a witch if you were left-handed, like stuff like this, that's like, how the fuck did this happen?
And it's obviously being removed from the DSM, but
yes.
I think it's important to note that like that idea still is so heavily like
entrenched in our society. Totally. We may have moved away from electrocuting women for hysteria, but you're right. Like we still have that kind of mental
hang up
and this imagery of women being like fucking hysterical and emotional, and they could never do a high powered job because they'll just be like, women.
Well, the episode we did recently about PMDD,
yes,
premenstrual dysphoric disorder, that was only recently added into the DSM.
Oh, right.
And that still has the hangover of hysteria, right? It's like, PMDD is that experience of, you know, you have to have at least five symptoms, whether that's like suicidal, depression, anxiety, whatever it is, before the 2 weeks before your period that then disappears.
Yeah.
But you can imagine back in the day, they would have been like, oh, she's hysteric.
She's hysterical.
Some other important diagnoses that were added into the DSM, the autism spectrum disorder, which was only added in 2013. We've got ADHD and PMDD. Like I said, PTSD was formally added to the DSM-3 in 1980 as well.
Yeah, it really makes you realize, like we were saying at the start of this, like it's such a young science. It is still so like underdeveloped, it seems like. The fact that autism being added in 2013 is really, really crazy. And we'll get to like the end of this and maybe have a chat about what the future is maybe looking like for psychology. But before we get there, we've been talking about these things being added and removed from the DSM, which is like the handbook, the Bible for psychologists. And obviously there are things that people get wrong. And there are so many experiments that psychology have somehow really stuck with society and people go, yep, that was correct and true.
The famous experiments.
Exactly. And I don't think we'll go super into detail with these, but there are a couple that we wanted to like flag with you.
So one of them was from 1961. It's called the Milgram Experiment. Basically, they wanted to find out how far ordinary people go if an authority figure tells them what to do. This is something that you probably have heard of, where basically participants were told that they were supposed to give electric shocks to another participant whenever they got an answer wrong. And what they didn't know was that the participants were actually actors and no real shocks were being given. And as the experiment continued, the shocks that they kept giving to them were getting stronger and stronger. The actor would yell, complain of pain, and eventually stop responding altogether. Many participants became clearly distressed and questioned whether they should continue. But when the researchers calmly insisted, many kept going. In fact, around 65% of the participants continued all the way to what they believed was the maximum potential dangerous voltage. So this experiment is talked about a lot because people go like, oh, well, people will do anything if someone tells them to do, right? Like a person of authority. But yeah, there's been a lot of backlash around that experiment because a lot of these ones are actually just a small group of people.
Yeah.
You know, it's like never been done again. It's all circumstantial, so it's so hard to then be like, oh, this is exactly how human behavior works.
Yeah, right. One that really sticks out to me is Stockholm Syndrome as well. Like that being like a pop psych thing, being like, okay, you fall in love with your captor. If you're in this weird, crazy scenario where somebody has like kidnapped you or taken you hostage, then you're going to swoon over them and you're going to develop a relationship. There have been many movies, many plot lines, all of this in pop culture. And it basically started in the 70s because this Swedish psychiatrist called Nils Bergsjö, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. I'm so sorry, Nils. but he was working as a police consultant during a bank robbery. It was really famous. Like there was this hostage situation. There was this young woman. She was 23 called Kristen Enmark. And she basically, from his eyes, formed this like emotional bond with the robber. Like he was like the lead robber and she was like swooning over him. And he implied that their connection was sexual. And that's why she was like spared and why she got out. And it was like a whole fucking mess. And then it became this whole thing that was like, oh, Stockholm Syndrome, you get obsessed with your captor. He actually never interviewed Kristen at all. So this psychologist who was like, yep, this is a thing. He never spoke to her. This never made it into the DSM, by the way.
Oh my God.
And now people just still continuously
talk
about it. It's obviously very rooted in sexist undertones. And also now we know when you are in a situation like that, there's like freeze, fawn. Like there's all these different things that you do to survive. Like she was literally just going, no, I was just trying to get out of there. Like I wasn't actually fucking in love with this guy. And she never even got interviewed by the dude. And so now we still say Stockholm Syndrome, which is crazy.
It is because so many of these.
This is my Roman Empire, by
the way. So many of these experiments are so flawed. It's like just quickly the Stanford prison experiment.
Right. Yeah. Big one.
Yeah. Well, they basically, you know, recruited 24 college students, prisoners, guards. But it was meant to run for 2 weeks, only lasted 6 days. Basically, the guards became increasingly authoritarian and were like really cruel. And he concluded, you know, ordinary people can become cruel when placed in systems that encourage cruelty. But there was so much that like wasn't spoken about in the fact that like he was actually in the actual researcher was in the experiment himself.
Right.
And so they were like, could he have been like encouraging it?
Yeah.
Also such a small group of people. Like it's just so fascinating.
Yeah. Which I think again, which is like, we like want to point these out just to be like, it's young there have been many mistakes made, and we have to be careful about the way that we understand like psychology, because yeah, there's these experiments that have not enough people, there's no control, yeah, like all of that.
And there's been a lot in pop psychology, right? Like, let's chat about some famous ones.
Yeah.
The same goes for love languages. So we did a whole episode on this, and love languages was a book or a term created, or a theory created by, wasn't he like a priest?
Yeah, like he was like a Christian or Mormon. Priest, and he was religious.
Religious background, no formal qualification at all in psychology or in therapy,
yeah,
whatsoever. And it was basically like, now in hindsight, like very hetero, and also a way to be like, women, like, you know, your man just has a different love language. Like, there's a lot of debate around love languages, but there's absolutely no, we've spoken to Dr. Jerry Karantzis on this.
Yes.
Absolutely no backing in science or research for love languages. Attachment theory. Yeah. Attachment theory is based in research and science, but it is one of those things that we've spoken about a lot on The Hookup, where it's to be taken not that seriously, right? Like, you can change from like insecure to secure, not to really identify too strongly with your attachment type.
But there's definitely moments of it where you can see how it's cherry picked from a lot of different psychologists throughout the years, which a lot of it does make sense. Like, you know, like nature and nurture and environment and stuff like that. You know, we talk about things, we've never really done an episode, but Let Them, very pop psych at the moment, like Mel Robbins,
you know, Let Them.
It got the really, really theory. Popular, and it's like such an interesting idea. And then I guess there was a lot of backlash when people started to be like, hold on, wait, should we be letting people do this? Again, it's a bit therapy, but it's also, you know, very tied to psychology as well.
No science or research behind that whatsoever. No,
just a lady with a microphone.
It is very pop psychology. It's just like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We just like terms that, you know, people throw around a lot. Narcissist, trauma bonding, boundaries, gaslighting.
Boundaries is huge because it's really has become really important, because I think it's given language for people to be able to, I don't know, like create, I guess, like a bit of a safety net for them if they've gone through maybe something that has been quote unquote traumatic, or you know, to be able to be like, hey, I actually am not comfortable with that. But I think these are kind of terms that have been taken a bit too far. We know the Jonah Hill example.
Jonah Hill of it all.
People, I think, have confused what boundaries actually mean, and people now use it to be like, I don't like you wearing bikinis. And that's my boundary
of mine.
And it's like, no, that's not a boundary.
Yeah. I think the whole thing with psychology and what people are realizing now too is that it has been a very Western kind of ideal. And a lot of modern psychologists have pointed out that there are problems with this, that the research being done are Western people, educated, industrialized, rich sometimes, democratic, political biases, all of these things. And I think that's something that maybe the field could work on more, is actually getting like a greater group of people, diversity. Vibes.
Diverse, yeah. And also if you think about what we've been talking about in this ep, the fact that psychology, the science of it is so young. Like you said, so much of that has been based off of Western educated rich people. And we live in a Western, our society is very individualistic, right? Which kind of goes hand in hand when you think about psychology. It's like, what are my problems? What are my unconscious? How do I deal with things? How do I behave?
Yeah.
What's my, you know, issues? And like a lot of societies outside of our Western society is actually about the collectivism. It's about like, collectively, like how do people work together? What are your relational therapies? And so, yeah, it's something for us to think about, I think, when we talk about psychology, like how much, or even just reflect on us as people going to psychologists.
Yeah.
How much it is really about, like, I don't know, sometimes I think, as someone who's such a huge fan of therapy, sometimes I think, like, am I just thinking about myself too much? Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, maybe it's not that deep. Maybe it's, like, it's important. I think therapy is so important. But sometimes I'm like, maybe I should just go actually be a better friend.
Yeah.
Maybe I should actually just volunteer. Maybe I should actually work on my village. Maybe, like, a lot of my problems would be solved if I didn't spend so much time just sitting on my ass thinking about myself.
Journaling. Yeah. Burn the journal. No, I'm kidding. It's really good. It's good. You know, there's this really famous meme that you just reminded me of. Is it Jemima Kerr?
Yeah, from Girls.
Girls. And she's like answering somebody's question on Instagram. We'll put it right here. But she basically just says something like, I think you girls are thinking a little bit too much about yourselves, which is kind of what you're saying. It's like sometimes it is not that deep and you need to get out of your own head.
Completely.
So funny.
And like your culture shapes how you think and feel and act. And so, yeah, I guess it's really, we are just a product of our environment, right? Like this is just what we've always known.
Yes.
And it's, yeah, it would be so fascinating to hear from people from different cultural backgrounds. Like I'd love for you to DM us. Maybe if you've moved to Australia or moved to the US or the UK or whatever, and you're kind of just like what's your interpretation of psychology and how we all think about ourselves. Like I'd love to hear what you think.
But speaking of what you just said, we're a product of our environment, our society, our culture. Let's look at the potential future of what psychology could be. 147 years in, we got plenty more to go. What the fuck's gonna happen next? And I think when we tap went onto the computer and said, computer, what's going on with psychology in the future? It was like AI. That's what came up. And I was like, fuck, this is true. I think a lot of psychologists are kind of worried about the fact that people are using AI chatbots as their therapists, as somebody to talk to. And they're like worried about what that could mean for humanity. Maybe they're also worried about like the ethical and moral implications of that. Do they need to work together with these chatbots? Or is it like we need to get rid of them? They're not doing good advice for people. So this is something that really came up when I was looking at this. And the fact that we like have AI, we have neuroscience, and we have so much data, and it's all fueling very like personalized like mental health plans for people. Whereas before it was very like, firstly, not many people talked about it. Secondly, it was just kind of like a blanket thing. Whereas now people can really get in and be like, my specific problem, help.
Even more individualistic.
Totally.
Which is so interesting because, yeah, you think about how there was actually, we haven't even talked about this, but there was a lot of stigma around mental health issues and mental health disorders and, you know, seeing a psychologist and going to therapy. And I think in Gen Z and even Gen Alpha, like this is so normal. Like it's actually encouraged. Everyone is, you know, talking about like there's some of those pop psychology terms we're talking about on TikTok. Like everyone has the language and the awareness now.
And
young people are more psychologically literate than ever, than any generation before them.
Yes. And the access to it as well. Even if we think about like the fact that there's like BetterHelp therapy. I get fucking ads on that all the time with every podcast I listen to. They're literally like, hey, BetterHelp, you know, like sign up today. Like just chat to a therapist like 24/7 whenever you want. Immediacy to this like is going to change it so crazy.
So I wonder like will we become even more isolated neurotic in ourselves or will having that language and the awareness actually make us healthier grow and better people?
I wonder if there'll be a point where we have, you know, we have GPs and you can just kind of walk down and get your physical and you can go talk to somebody about that. Like maybe there'll just be stuff.
Get your mental at the same time.
Yeah. Like maybe there'll be like a psychologist office or a therapy office that will operate kind of like a GP and you can kind of just walk in and do an appointment and it's like there. I feel like that would be kind of a good thing, maybe.
I think you're right about AI, though. I really have a feeling people will just be chatting to chatbots about the issues.
Yeah.
But I also think, like, fingers crossed, we'll hopefully have more science and research, like you said, in neuroscience. But also, I hope, holistic approach to psychology. So I would like to see more, which I think we're heading in that direction, of, like, research and science into the gut. Brain connection, looking at the way that your body holistically is potentially wiring your brain or changing, you know, certain pathways that give you potentially like depression, bipolar, whatever it is that you're struggling with.
Yeah.
And how, like we could hopefully change that as well through science. That, and then like, you know, PMDD is one of the most under-researched conditions. It's like hopefully a lot of these mental health issues and conditions will hopefully have a lot more research behind them.
Yep.
So we can get some better help.
Fingers crossed. Well, this was really fun. Thank you so much for going on this ride. And I think we cannot stress enough this was psychology light.
I was about to say.
And being like, where the fuck was your chat about structuralism and humanism more and behaviorism? I'm like,
babes.
No time.
We had 40 minutes.
We're up to an hour now. So. Sorry if we missed anything. We tried to keep it really brief but fun, and we hope you learned something.
All right. Love you.
Bye.
Bye.